Hello and welcome to Zing Talk, where Ben Zinga brings you the biggest names and brightest minds from Silicon Valley to New York City. Today our guest is Peter Schiff, the president of Euro-Pacific Capital. How are you doing today, Peter?
I am well. How are you?
I'm doing great. Now, first things first, in your last interview with Ben Zinga, you said that you felt that gold was going to go up to 5,000 an ounce. Do you still feel that's true? And what sort of timeline are you expecting on that?
Oh, I mean, I think it's going to go there. It's always hard to figure out exactly how long it's going to take. I don't think it's, going to take 10 or 20 years. It can do that in a year. It can do it in 2 years. I mean, it can do it in 6 months. I don't know. But I do think that the price of gold is going a lot higher. So from that perspective, you really don't have to know how much higher it's going to go. You simply have to realize it's going to go a lot higher than it is today. And so it makes sense to buy it. You don't have to know exactly where it's going to go and how long it's going to take, unless you're trying to do some kind of option strategy. But if you're just a normal person and you're looking to buy gold, the key is just to buy it.
So you think it's more of a buy and hold type strategy?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're going to try to speculate on short-term swings, I mean, you could do that in anything. You can do that in gold. You can do that in just about any commodity. You can go to a racetrack on a horse. So I'm not encouraging people to try to guess the short-term movements and the price of gold, but I know that the long-term movements are going to be up. So
now that the primary season has ended and your campaign is over, do you intend to stay politically active this election cycle, possibly run as an independent or any other activity?
Well, I'm not running for office as an independent, so that answer there is no. Might I do something to help support other candidates? I might, depending on which candidates they are and what kind of help they ask me to provide, but I'm certainly open to helping other candidates that I think will be able to lead this country in the direction that it needs to go in.
Any candidates in particular that you think have the Peter Schiff endorsement?
Well, I've endorsed Rand Paul, who's running for Senate in Kentucky. So, he's one that comes to mind, but, he hasn't approached me asking me for any active support other than, I think I did participate in a radio show that was promoting a money bomb for Rand a couple of days ago, so.
Why in particular are you in support of Rand Paul?
Because Rand understands the problem and he understands the solution. So I support him and I think he's sincere. The biggest problem with politicians is knowing who's sincere and who's just telling you what you want to hear so you'll vote for them. And I'm very familiar with Rand's father. He's a very principled man. He's been in Congress for a long time. He's got the best voting record in Congress. He's got a lot of integrity, and I think his son will share that. I think he was raised by the right person, and he's not a politician. He's been a doctor, and first time he's seeking office, and it's not because he wants to be a politician. It's because he knows that the career politicians are destroying the country, and he wants to help. So I think we need more people like him running for office.
Right. And now, are the midterm elections coming up going to have a big impact on the market, or is that just an exaggerated idea? I mean, on CNBC, like, you hear people say market gridlock's good for, or political gridlock's good for the market.
Gridlock would be better than what we have now, right? I mean, because anything that we have is just doing damage. So to the extent that we can put a brake on the Obama agenda, that's a positive. But it's not going to be, the market's still going down. Depression is still going to proceed because the Republicans are not going to do the right thing either. They might stop Democrats from doing more substantial damage than they would otherwise do, but the bottom line is the government is still going to be damaging the economy and impeding recovery regardless of the outcome of the election.
So you think that the Republican Party isn't a good alternative either? I mean, you support specific candidates like Rand Paul, but the party in general isn't offering a better direction?
No. I mean, the Republicans are objecting to some of the things that Obama's doing. But if Bush were doing those things, they would be supporting him. There are a lot of things that Bush did. Look at the original bailout, the original stimulus. Those were Bush plans that got Republican backing. Why weren't the Republicans opposed to Bush when he was pursuing policy?
Because he was a Republican.
Yeah. So, they might oppose some of the Democrats doing the same thing, but are they going to push through the type of legislation that we need? Big reductions in government spending? Cuts to entitlement programs? No. Are they going to push to get the government out of the housing market to shut down Fannie and Freddie? No, they're not going to do any of those things. You know, are they going to, you know, so the problems are still going to be there regardless.
Now, speaking of Fannie and Freddie, there was just recently a summit on what exactly to do with them. So do you advocate just getting rid of them entirely or maybe not having them at all, maybe privatize them or?
Well, there's no way to privatize them. I mean, that's what we tried before. They were private with government guarantees. Now, if you privatize them without government guarantees, nobody would want to own them because they could just go bankrupt. So, you know, I mean, if the private market, I mean, the private sector could develop companies like Fannie and Freddie without the government's help. I mean, I can go out and raise capital and start a business to guarantee mortgages. You know, I mean, look, there's all sorts of private companies that guarantee risk. I mean, that's what insurance companies do. They underwrite risk. So if insurance companies want to provide insurance on mortgages defaulting, they can do it. We don't need the government to do it. But of course, if the private sector did it, it would accurately price the risk of default. And so if we have the private sector doing it, the interest rates would be higher when people are buying homes. Down payment requirements would be higher. Credit standards would be stricter. But of course, that's what we want. You know, the government wants to perpetuate the environment of lax lending standards. The government wants people to buy houses that they can't afford. But the free market wouldn't allow that.
So you're saying that not everyone should be a homeowner, obviously. So the private market would be better at handling that.
Right. Well, not everybody should be a homeowner, and not everybody should own a McMansion. I mean, you know, you can buy a house. It doesn't have to you know, be 4,000 square feet. I mean, a lot of people are buying bigger houses than they really can afford or that they need. I mean, if you think about it, look at the average size of the homes that our grandparents had. We're much smaller than the homes that we have today. And one of the main reasons for that is our grandparents didn't get big subsidies to buy homes the way Americans do today. So I want Americans living in homes that they can actually afford, right? And I want builders to build homes that Americans can afford, not that Americans can pay for because they get a government subsidy.
And another thing that you've talked a lot about in your commentary for Europac and in different media appearances is about how saving and investment, how we need to be incentivizing that rather than trying to push people into demand now. Should we be withdrawing the stimulus measures that we have in place right now that are supporting consumer demand and then
Absolutely.
Just hope that?
Yeah, I was just watching today, Howard Dean was on CNBC defending, you know, why we need tax cuts for the middle class, but tax increases for the rich, right? And his reasoning was the middle class will spend the money, but the rich are just going to save it or invest it. And so if we tax the rich, it doesn't hurt the economy because it just reduces the amount of investments. You know, but that kind of logic it assumes that, you know, the reason our economy is in trouble is because we have too much saving and investment and not enough spending. That it's the exact opposite. We have too much spending and not enough investing. We can't take money that would have been invested and instead take it and distribute it to people so they can spend it. That's how we destroy this economy. So we're not going to be able to have a growing economy. We're not going to produce goods and services. We're not going to provide employment unless we have investment, unless we have savings. You know, right now, whatever money the private sector is saving, the government is squandering. So the money is not there. I mean, if people want to know, why is it that business can't get credit? Because the credit's not there. Because the government took it all.
And simple economics will dictate that you need to have some sort of savings in order to expand the capital and growth base. So you can't just take away all that and just hope that growth will continue anyways. But I mean, right now the American economy is propelled by about 70% consumer spending. Do you think that should be maybe down closer to 50 or 60?
Who knows where it should be? But remember, our economy is not propelled by American spending money. It's propelled by the Chinese, who are producing the products that we're buying and who are loaning us the money to purchase them. That's what's propelling our economy. You know, it's the fact that the rest of the world is producing, not the fact that we're consuming. But that can't, you know, go on indefinitely because the Chinese are going to figure out, and so is the rest of the world, that this is a bad deal for them. That, you know, they're better off, you know, consuming what they produce themselves and investing their savings in their own economy rather than buying our treasury bills. So This whole phony economy is going to come collapsing down, and we're going to realize that real economic growth can only come from savings and production. It can never come from spending. The only thing that comes from spending is inflation.
Now, last time we spoke, the economy seemed like it may have been on the path to recovery. There were green shoots. People were thinking that we might be in the clear. We weren't out of the woods, but people were starting to think that we might be getting there. But now, even the Fed is worried about the possibility of a double dip, and they're ramping up their quantitative easing strategy to combat that. Where do you think the economy is headed right now, and what can we do to sustain a recovery?
Well, the only people who thought the economy was recovering didn't understand the disease. They didn't even know why the economy was sick. So they believed that we were recovering when, in fact, we were simply, becoming more infected with the same disease. We've got a worse case of it. The problem is that because of the government stimulus, the economy is sicker now than it was before, right? We have greater imbalances. We're more deeply indebted. And worse than that, we've socialized more of the economy. We now have the government controlling, mortgages, banking, healthcare. The government is intruding into the economy in ways that are more destructive to our productivity than they were before. So we're moving away from a market-based economy to a centrally planned economy, and this is just compounding our problem. So what we have to do to have a real recovery is to understand the disease, to understand what's wrong with the economy. And again, the reason the economy is in trouble is because interest rates were too low for too long. Government subsidies to housing resulted in Americans spending too much money. We bought things that we couldn't afford. Our savings rate went to zero, went negative. Our trade deficit went through the roof as we kept buying things that we couldn't afford, that we didn't make. And the reason that we felt comfortable doing it was because everybody thought they were rich because they lived in a house that would appreciate forever. So it was a huge fantasy economy. And now reality is coming back. Americans are starting to realize that they're broke, and they're rightly making decisions to stop spending, to start saving, and we have to transform ourselves from a phony economy where everybody spends borrowed money to a real economy where people save up money and we produce things. And we have to allow that transition to take place, because only if we have that transition can we recover. If we refuse to acknowledge what's wrong with the country and we refuse to allow the cure, see, this recession is the cure. Rather than resisting it, we have to embrace it. We have to understand that it's the bitter-tasting medicine that we have to swallow to get better. But if we simply say, no, we can't take that medicine, right, because it's bad politics, we have to do whatever we can to keep stimulating, then they're going to kill the patient. Then we're going to overdose on stimulus, and they're going to destroy the economy completely, and it's going to be horrific. And then it'll be much more painful than if we had simply, bit the bullet.
Now, are there any Peter Schiff legislative prescriptions that we might be able to do? I know that you say the government should be getting out of things, but is there anything maybe to set the context or initiatives that might be able to be done in order to help that process along?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing that's going to help it along is for the government to get as small as possible. I mean, we have to dig ourselves out from a gigantic hole. And, we can't do it with the government, standing on all the shovels. So we need to get the government to get out of the way. But there are certain things that the government can do legislatively that would really help our economy, and it wouldn't cost any money. They can deregulate healthcare so that, healthcare insurance rates come down, so that healthcare is less expensive. They can stop subsidizing education so that college tuitions will plunge, so that it won't cost people so much money to go to college. There's a lot of things the government can do very simply that cost nothing that can help bring down costs for average Americans to make this transition a little bit easier. And of course, what we are going to have to do is we're going to have to cut back dramatically on government spending. We're going to have to cut the pay that we pay government workers. We're going to have to cut back on the money that we dole out in entitlements. But if we do that, we can also lower taxes on businesses, on individuals, to make it easier to invest. And if we can repeal a lot of these rules and regulations that make America so uncompetitive, we can attract a lot more foreign capital as well. So we can rebuild all the factories that have been shut down. We have a dynamic economy if the government would simply unleash it, if the government would simply get out of the way. So, we can right this ship. But the problem is, if the government sinks it to the bottom of the ocean first, then we're not going to be able to do it.
Now, I just want to clarify one thing. You said that if we ended the college tuition subsidies, the tuition price would come down. How exactly would that work if we end the subsidies, which politicians would argue that are keeping the prices down?
No. The subsidies don't keep, when you subsidize something, you make it more expensive, not less expensive. What happens is, the government guarantees student loans just the way they guarantee, mortgages. And because students can go borrow money with a government guarantee, they have more money to spend on college tuitions. So the colleges are free to raise their tuition prices every year because they know that however high they raise them, the students will be able to borrow the money thanks to government guarantees. But if you get the government out of the education market completely, very few Americans could actually afford to go to college if they had to pay these prices without government loans. So what would happen is that lack of demand for college degrees would force the institutions to slash their prices to levels that would attract attendance. Just like any other industry, you know, when the airlines can't sell their seats, they lower the prices. You know, when a clothing store can't sell its merchandise, it has a sale. What we need in college is a 50% off sale, a 70% off clearance sale. We need these universities lowering their prices. And they will do that if the government gets out of the way. They'll have no choice. Otherwise, they'll have no students. They'll have no customers.
Yeah, and then that's not a good thing for their bottom lines either.
Well, it is because it forces them to, you know, restructure and get lean and mean. It forces them to look through their budgets and decide, we don't need this, we don't need that, we're overpaying this person. I mean, these, you know, universities and colleges are very inefficient, you know, because they haven't had market forces pushing down their prices. So I want to bring efficiencies into the educational system. And yes, is it going to be a bad thing for some university professor who basically lectures for, you know, a couple hours a week and makes $250,000-$300,000 a year? Yeah, you know, he's probably going to have to actually show up and teach more often. And he's not going to get paid as much. But you know what? I mean, okay. Because there are a lot of people that are overpaid, and there might be several administrators or bureaucrats that are working in that university that basically they aren't even needed. So lay them off. Let them do something else. Let them do something productive.
All right, Peter, and I just got one more question for you that I can't let you get off the phone without asking. I got one more question about the Art Laffer bet. Has he paid up?
Well, not only has Art Laffer not paid me, but he refuses to admit I won the bet. He actually believes he won.
Still.
Yes, because he says the economy was in great shape back in late 2006. And that it was in great shape, and that the only reason it collapsed a couple of years later because of these mistakes that were made. But according to him, at the time we had this debate, it was the greatest economy ever. We had the best Fed policy ever. It's nonsense. And if you watch that whole debate on YouTube, you know, just do Peter Schiff and Art Laffer and watch this 10 minutes. I mean, he was wrong on everything he said. And of course, I was right on everything he said. And, you know, he's the one that wanted to bet me. He said, let's bet. But more than betting me a penny, he said, it's our honor at stake. You know, let's write a note. The person that was wrong has to write a note apologizing to the person who was right. It was his idea to make the bet. I just accepted it. Now, I wanted to bet more than a penny, but you know, he welched on it anyway. So if I'd have bet him $1 million, obviously I wouldn't have collected on that, you know. But he wouldn't even pay me a penny.
Peter, we'll keep having you come on to pressure Art to pay up. Thank you for coming on this episode of Zing Talk. Remember to check out the latest market-moving information, commentary, and trading ideas on www.benzinga.com.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Be sure to subscribe in iTunes. You can find a link to do that right off of the Benzinga homepage. The music that you're listening to is Beethoven Virus by Banya and is available on the Internet Archive. All Benzinga podcasts are released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.5 license, and all other rights are reserved.